Anyway, it's good to see everyone, and welcome to those who may be online. The subject that I'm going to talk about today is more vivid than a soap opera. It's full of colorful personalities, and it's a mixture of joy and tragedy. The laughter and sorrow will be throughout. And it's a true story. It involves sex, politics, and religion. I mean, what more could you ask for? Let's turn to Matthew 1:1. In Matthew 1:1, and this starts out, it's really starting out with a genealogy of Jesus. In Matthew 1:1, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, and it goes through and it recites, Abraham begat Isaac, Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judas and his brethren. And we go down the line, Judas and begat Phares and Zerah of Tamar and so forth. And it keeps on going and it goes through verse 14 and it lists selected ancestries of Jesus Christ. Now, it didn't tell them all, but I will note that there were five women listed in the genealogy. And it lists Tamar, and Rahab, and Ruth, and Bathsheba, and Mary. Now, this was over 30-some years ago that I first started looking at this and saying, well, this is really strange. Why are those particular women listed? Because there are a bunch of women who were not listed that you would normally think would be there. Not listed was Eve, the wife of Adam, the first human mother. Not listed was Noah's wife, also the mother of all living. Not listed was Sarah, Abraham's wife. Not listed was Rebecca, Isaac's wife. Not listed was Leah or Rachel, the wives of Jacob. And so we have this circumstance that there is one woman that is listed that I want to talk about today. And to examine the life and lessons regarding that one woman listed in Matthew 1 is the woman named Tamar, because there are profound lessons for us today from the story of Tamar's life. So we're going to see some of the reasons that she was listed as an ancestry of Jesus the Christ. Now, as I've mentioned, this story has more twists and turns than a mystery novel or a wild movie plot. As they say, truth is stranger than fiction, and the story of Tamar's life is rarely, if ever, told because it's terribly awkward. It's extremely embarrassing and often unseemly. Well, this is told in the chapter of Genesis, verse 38. And you might put a bookmark in Genesis 38 because we're going to refer from time to time to that chapter. Now, let's put it in perspective. The previous chapter, Genesis 37, is about Joseph, the son of Jacob, the grandson of Isaac, great-grandson of Abraham. And Genesis 37 tells us about Joseph's dreams and how Joseph was sold into slavery to Egypt by his brothers. And then the story, while Joseph is in Egypt, then we have chapter 38, and we read about this story about Tamar. Well, what's up with that? And then we have this inset chapter in chapter 38, and then after that we have chapter 39 where it goes back to Joseph in Egypt, how Joseph was rejected the illicit advances of Potiphar's wife. He was thrown in prison and so forth. So you have this chapter, some reason set in there after 37 and before 39. So when we go through this story of Tamar, we're going to see what a contrast the life of Judah was to his much younger brother, Joseph. Now, Tamar's life is inextricably intertwined with the life of Judah, one of Joseph's older brothers. Now, Judah was the son of Leah. He was the fourth son of Jacob. There was Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and then Judah. And Judah was able, when Joseph was thrown into a pit by his brothers, Judah was able to convince his brothers that they shouldn't kill the younger brother, Joseph. It was Judah suggested the brothers could make a little money off the deal and sell him to some traveling traders. And we read that in Genesis 37, verses 26, when Judah said, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Verse 27, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Well, these were like their second cousins. and their relatives. So they were distant cousins, and they were traders. And it talks about, you know, they sold him to sold him off, and he wound up in Egypt. So Joseph is out of the picture. So for this generation or this time period, then we have Genesis 38 is a time frame for the story of Tamar. If we start, go to Genesis 38, and we start in verse 1, we read, "And it came to pass at that time." What time are they talking about? Well, it's right after Genesis 37, that time when Joseph was thrown into the pit and sold to the Ishmaelite traders and transported to Egypt. So we read on in Genesis 38:1, "It came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira." Hira the Adullamite will appear later in this story, and so we'll want to make a mental note that Hira was Judah's friend. In Genesis 38, verse 2, and it talks about Judah saw a gal there and married her. And the story goes on in verses 3 and 4 and 5, where she had three sons. And the three sons Judah had and his wife had were Onan, and Shelah. Now, the Bible commentary by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown notes, Judah did just like his uncle Esau and married outside of their religion into a Canaanite family, and that such a marriage turns out to be a major contributor to the problems that were to follow. And this is where Tamar is introduced into the story. So first of all, Judah's oldest son, it was common for the parents to arrange the marriage for their children. So Judah arranged for Tamar to become the wife of his oldest son. We can turn to Genesis 38, verse 6. "And unfortunately, wasn't raised right. He was wicked, and God allowed him to die." In Genesis 38.6, we read that Judah selected Tamar to be the wife, and Judah's firstborn was wicked, and the Lord slew him. I looked up the word slew, and it could also be interpreted to be lack of protection or allowed to die. And it was a custom in that day for arranged marriages. And the reason it was important was for inheritance purposes. The father selected the daughter-in-law who would bear their future, the one who would be the future inheritor of their estate. The second point that occurred then is that Judah arranged for Tamar to marry the second son, Onan. Well, you see, now we have a young widow. The first husband died, and this was what we call, according to the Levirate principle, that if a man died without having a son, the dead man's brother was to marry the widow and raise up a son to inherit the older brother's estate. And that's what happened in this case, or was expected to happen. And there's a couple of other laws of inheritance that are in play here. But one is the law of primogeniture and the Levirate law of marriage. Now, the law of primogeniture is the right of the firstborn to inherit a double portion. So if you have two children or two sons to inherit, the eldest would inherit, they divide the estate into three, and the eldest would inherit two of the three, two-thirds of the estate. In Deuteronomy 21, and verses 15 through 17, actually go down to verse 17, we talk about the inheriting child receives a double portion and the right of the first, and being the right of the firstborn. Then we have also in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10, we have this discussion of the Levirate law of marriage. And this is the marriage duty of the surviving brother. And it goes through and talks about if brothers dwell together and one of them dies, doesn't have a son, the widow of the dead shall not be married to a stranger. She shall be married to the bachelor brother. And it'll go through, but the child that's raised will be considered the child of the older brother, the dead one. So it's for inheritance purposes. And we have this example in here in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10, where, and this is, what will happen if somebody doesn't do it, their name will be besmirched. They will be shamed in their community. Now, this Leverett principle of marriage has been around for a long time. My grandmother was married about 100 years ago, and actually a little over that, and she was married to one of a pair of brothers. So, and the brothers farmed together. They owned the family homestead, my great-grandfather homesteaded it, and one was a married son, one was a bachelor son, and my grandmother was 19, got married, they had two little children, and then her husband died. It happened very quickly, a farm accident, he got infection, and 3 days later he was dead. Well, this is a scandal. The married brother lived downstairs with the kids, and the bachelor brother lived upstairs, same house. Well, what are we going to do here? You know, the scandal, and they all each own now half the farm, except that there was no will. He was a young man. He was 30 years old, the one who died. And the law said, with no will, half of the estate goes to the widow and half to the children. Well, with two children, that means, and the widow only owned half the farm to begin with, so the widow owned a quarter of the farm. Each of the children owned an eighth, and the bachelor brother owned half the farm, as he always did. So my great-grandfather called them in, horse and buggy, to his place, and they went there, and he said, "You need to marry the farm back together again." And so they did. Now, and at that time, this is where there was no electric lights or running water, and so they followed the advice, they got married. Now, as a kid growing up, I would hear comments from the older neighbor farmers about my grandparents having a marriage of convenience, or a comment that it was a business arrangement. Well, it always puzzled me, why would I hear such things? I mean, I didn't find out until I was a young teenager that about this situation. And the death of my grandmother in 1986, in January, my father was 60 years old, and we were standing together at the cemetery. This was in January in Minnesota, a week before HWA died. And we're standing there, the last two. Everybody else went to the reception. And my grandfather, or my dad, gave the, and he said, "You know, buried my mother today." He said, "And in my entire life, I never heard my parents say a cross word to each other." And I was kind of stunned because I didn't know that was humanly possible. And then he said something even weirder. He said, "And I only know two couples like that." Well, what do you suppose my next question was? Well, who's that? Well, my grandmother's sister and her husband. And I thought, well, you know what? It's true. I've never heard them. And yet, for being a marriage of convenience, an arranged marriage or selected, it was really quite a remarkable arrangement. Well, and their marriage lasted over 50 years until grandfather died. At the time, in Matthew 22, starting in verse 24, this is at the time of Jesus Christ, the Sadducees questioned Christ, using the Leverett law to challenge Christ regarding the resurrection. And they go through the example, if a man dies and doesn't have children, his brother will marry the wife and so forth, and they don't have a child, and he dies, and it goes through, and it goes seven times, and goes on to explain this succession. You know, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? You know, trying to trip up Jesus to make this. But they all understood the Leverett law of marriage. So let's go back to the story of Tamar now. Judah instructed his second son Onan to marry the young widow Tamar in Genesis 38, verse 8. And he said, "And raise up a child, or raise up the seed for your brother." And verse 9, "And Onan knew that his seed," meaning his son, "would not be his. And then he practiced a primitive form of birth control so that he would not have a child by Tamar." Verse 10, "The thing which he did displeased the Lord, and he died also." So we aren't given the particular of Ur's death, and we aren't given the particulars of Onan's death. And we're left to speculate that why Onan did not want to have a son by Tamar, but it's not difficult to see that Onan's son by Tamar would have been legally Ur's son and would have displaced him in the inheritance. So his own biological son would be considered his legal superior, and he would be aced out of an inheritance. And any other sons that he had would be lesser by comparison in the inheritance. Now, Judah's father, I might point out at the time, Jacob, he was alive at the time. And so Judah was in line to become the chief inheritor of the father Jacob's estate. And there's a lot of money riding on the line when you consider the father of all of the children of Israel, because Judah was the fourth son. And you go, wait a minute, how can that be? Well, Reuben disqualified himself. Simeon and Levi, we can read in 1 Chronicles 5 and verse 1 about how Reuben disqualified himself. And then in Genesis 34, starting in verse 25, we read how Simeon and Levi disqualified themselves for the inheritance. And that really brought it down to, in Genesis 34, verse 25, and Genesis 34, verse 30, when Simeon and Levi went out and slew the, on the matter of Dinah, and slaughtered local Canaanites. As Jacob said, you make my name stink. So there were three older brothers that disqualified themselves, and that's a story really for another day. But they had blood on themselves, on their hands. So now we have Judah's fourth son, and you would say, well, wait a minute. Joseph was the eldest son of the next wife. But remember, Jacob didn't know that. He was told his son had died when he was secretly shipped off to Egypt. So he was looking at, inheritance-wise, well, who's left? Well, that leaves Judah to be left. And Judah's oldest son, Ur, was dead, no heir. Onan was dead and no heir. And now, Onan might have figured out in his own mind that if he could have a child after the death of Judah, then he wouldn't be bound to having a child by Tamar. So we'll just wait it out and see what happened. I'm just a theory of mine, but Onan's plans didn't materialize. So when Onan died, he left the third son, Shelah, and the youngest son. The point is to ask why Tamar didn't simply inherit the estate on her own for her husband, either husband's estate. Because that would have settled the matter. The widow gets everything, and that's the way it is. And, of course, modern law, that's what would happen. But that's not how the world worked at that time. The wife wasn't the heir, but the right to the wife descended with the property to the next of kin. And so the right to marry Tamar was a heritable right. It could be inherited, and that's what was happening. Now, then the laws of inheritance, we read in Numbers 27, and we can read through that, how it works with the sons and daughters or near kinsmen. We read about Moses and the daughters of Zelophehad and so forth, and we read about the laws of inheritance. But there's another example in Ruth in chapter 4 and verse 1. There's another well-known biblical example where the levirate law of marriage was practiced, where the right to marry the widow was an inheritable right and even involved real estate. And we read about in Ruth chapter 4, verse 1, Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. Now, the gate is where the decisions were made. It's sort of like the public square where things were done. You didn't need a notary. You went to the public or went to the gate in public. It says, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spoke came, by whom he said, hello, such a one, turn aside and sit here. So he called in the person who had the right to marry Ruth. Verse 2, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and says, sit down. In other words, I want witnesses here. And he told, and this is Boaz, told the kinsman, that Naomi came back from Moab, and she has a piece of property, which was Elimelech's, her husband's, meaning But the so do you want the property? Who has the right to the property? Somebody has the right to the property. Elimelech is dead. And he says, do you want to redeem it to somebody who is closer related? And if we read on in verse 4, he says to the kinsman, if you'll redeem it, but if you don't, then I will. And he says, because I come after you. So he's getting witnesses here. And then Boaz brings up the fine print. Ever get bitten in a contract by the fine print? You know, that little tiny six-point font that's down on the bottom in verse 6 or verse 5. But whoever buys that field from the hand of Naomi must also buy it of it by Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. In other words, it'll only be yours for a little while, but not for your children. It'll go following the name of Elimelech and his line. And what in verse 6, the kinsman said, I can't redeem it for myself, lest I mar my own inheritance. So go ahead, redeem it for yourself, because I can't redeem it. So now Boaz had witnesses that he was going to marry Ruth. It cleared the deck for any challenge. You might think of this in the sense of, we're going through the title company before we purchase a piece of property. Is there any other claim on the property that could rise to dispute the title? And so we now have the 10 witnesses there that says that Boaz was free and clear. And it's interesting, if we go down to verse 12, when the announcement was made then for Boaz to marry Ruth, verse 12, and let your house be like the house of Pharaoh's whom Tamar bore to Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give of this young woman. In other words, may you be fruitful and productive, just like your ancestor, and so there's a certain similarity here from Tamar and then down the line that we have that reference in there. In fact, it was many years ago, I was talking to a deacon in Minnesota, and I said, what I don't understand is, why are those women listed in Matthew 5? Why them as compared to the other ones? And he boiled it down to this. And I, being young and unlearned, he said, well, it's simple. Under ordinary circumstances, they shouldn't be there. All of them showed up under wild and unpredictable circumstances. And look how many were not even of the tribe of Israel. They had to be then grafted in. We also find in Genesis 38, then in verse 11, after the second son died, the second husband of Tamar, in Genesis 38:11, we have Judah tells Tamar, go to your father's house to live. In other words, you can't live here because the third son is too young. He says, you got to wait till he's grown, because now the third son is in line to marry Tamar. Now, she was both a widow and a betrothed woman, sort of like living in a nether world, neither one nor place nor the other, not living at her father-in-law's house. So at once, both being a widow and an engaged woman, the only place to live was back at her father's house. And then we note, as we read on in Genesis 38, verse 4, Tamar waited for Shelah to grow up. And she waited, she waited, and she waited. And when the third son reached adulthood, now normally the age of the adulthood is age 20. Well, we aren't given the exact number of years, but it's possible that Tamar waited 10 or 15 years for the third son, Shelah, to grow up to marriageable age. But as we read in verse 11, Judah was worried his third son would also die suddenly, just as did the first two sons. Sort of like, that woman is a kind of a curse. Marry her, you're going to die. Well, they kind of have some credibility there when the first two husbands have died. And in chapter 38, verse 4, Judah did not arrange for Shelah to marry Tamar. Now, What impact does that make? If Judah delayed the marriage of Tamar to his third son, he delayed then the eventual birth of a son by Tamar to inherit Judah's estate in the name of Ur, the oldest son. And in Exodus 22, verse 29, we read about the offering of first fruits. You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe fruits and of your liquors, the firstborn of your sons you shall also give to me. In other words, there's an inheritance coming here from the firstborn. But it wasn't just Judah's estate here, because Judah was condemning Tamar to a lifetime of widowhood and childlessness. She couldn't marry anyone else, and so she would remain childlessness. And they didn't have Social Security or public programs as they do today. She would be living at the behest of her father's household, and then at whoever else would manage to take care of her. She would have no children to look after her. In that sense, Judah was then oppressing a widow, the widow Tamar. In Zechariah 7, starting in verse 9, in Zechariah 7, 9, thus speaks the Lord of hosts, saying, execute true judgment and show mercy and compassions, every one to his brother, verse 10, and not oppress the widow, nor the fatherless, nor the stranger, the poor. Let none of you imagine evil against his brother in your hearts. We read on in Exodus 22 and verse 40, you shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child, and so forth. Verse 23, I will hear their cry. So by denying by delaying the marriage of the third son, Shelah, to Tamar, he was denying the marriage and the opportunity for Tamar to become a mother. Judah was setting himself up for a nasty fall. We've already read now that not good things happen to people then that oppress the widow. So what happens then in Genesis 38, verse 12? Judah's wife dies. So in the process of Shelah growing up and the Judah's wife died, and Judah was comforted and went to his sheep shearers to Timnath and his friend Hira the Adullamite. Remember Hira the Adullamite? That was his friend back when he found his first wife, or his wife, Shua. And of course, when you go to, during sheep shearing season, that's a big production, a huge production. You don't do it alone. You need a lot of people, a lot of help. Well, knowing this, and you can't keep secrets, there was no social media of the day, but everybody knew when you have a sheep shearing event, you have this huge, everybody gathers together. And I grew up when I was a kid during harvest season, the neighbors all helped and they went around from farm to farm to farm, and whoever was the host fed everybody. That was especially true in previous generations who had horses and buggies and primitive equipment. I mean, I grew up with tractors. But if you look at the more primitive equipment, they made a party out of every harvest was a party. It was going to be, and it was a big social event at that time. So I can easily imagine that the sheep shearing season was similar. And so everybody knew what was going to happen. So when we read then, that there was no marriage on the horizon for Tamar. Tamar became impatient, decided to take matters into her own hands. Sometimes these things aren't such a good idea. But she did what she did. In Genesis 38, verse 14, Tamar put her widow's garments off from her because she wore the garments that would signify that she's a widow, covered herself with a veil, couldn't really see who she was, and wrapped herself and sat in an open place on the way to Timnath, because she saw that the third son, Shelah, was grown and she wasn't given to wife. Now, here's where Tamar was scheming to become pregnant. Now, she had the legal right to bear the inheritor of Judah's estate. And this had to be a large enough estate that it was worth that. And Tamar determined if she wasn't going to marry Judah's son, she would find another way to become pregnant and bear a son to inherit Judah's and Jacob's estate. Remember, we're looking at Jacob's estate, not just Judah's, because Jacob was still alive. Verse 38, Genesis 38, verse 13, it was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law goes to Timnath to shear his sheep." In other words, she knew it was coming down. And if we read then, according to the Bible commentary of Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the sheep shearing season in that month occurred near the end of March. And the sheep shearing season was when wealthy owners invited their friends and servants and neighbors and treated them to dining and parties after each day's work. So we know that that Tamar dressed herself in a veil and was on by the roadside, you might say a streetwalker. And verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot because she covered her face. Apparently that was the standard for them, so you couldn't be readily identified. Now, you'd think that Judah would have recognized Tamar. After all, he picked her out to be the son of his eldest, or the wife of his eldest son, and then instructed her to marry his second son. But bear in mind, it could have been quite a while. It could have been years. And it may be that he hadn't seen her for over 10 years, maybe more. She went back to live in her father's household, and of course, her face was covered with a veil. And then we read in Genesis 38, starting in verse 16, became the bargaining. Judah was a widower. He was lonely and wanted companionship. So he bargained with this veil-covered woman on the side of the road. And he bargained. And what did she say? Tamar wanted proof. Now, she didn't say who she was, but she wanted proof that it was Judah. And so she said, when he said back in verse 16, what do you want? And she said, a kid from the flock. And of course, he didn't have an animal to give her. So he said, well, what pledge, what collateral can I give you to demonstrate this? And so she said three things: your signet, your bracelet, and the staff that's in your hand. Now, and he gave those three things to her as proof that he would send a kidlet from the flock to her for payment for their dalliance. Now, I went to my old college textbook. I had an Old Testament survey class, and it's a book entitled The Old Testament Speaks. It's a commentary by Samuel Schultz, and Schultz noticed that the ancient Ugaritic and Mesopotamian sources said three items were necessary for personal identification. And this is what Tamar did. She obtained Judah's signet. Now, it's a ring on his finger, or it could have been carried on a rope or chain on his neck, a bracelet, his staff. And each of those items were personalized in some manner so everyone would recognize him. And Tamar's efforts to get three items of the collateral to back up Judah's pledge isn't much different than us going down to get a new driver's license. You got to have several pieces of identification to get that license. So, or if you're trying to get a Social Security card, you've got to have several sources of personal identification. And at the time, there were societal rules about taking a pledge. In Exodus 22, in verse 26, we read about a pledge of personal property, such as a coat, cannot be retained overnight. In Exodus 22, verse 26, it says you got to return that because you don't want somebody freezing overnight. They gave you a pledge. And so the expectation was that the pledge would be redeemed immediately or very quickly. But Judah might also have come to his senses and realized his identification was out there and he could be ratted out. And that could be rather awkward. So what he did in Genesis 38, verse 19, it says, she arose and went away and took the veil from her and put back on the garments of widowhood. And what did Judah do? He sent his buddy, Hira the Adullamite, to go retrieve the pledges. In other words, drop off the kid from the flock and retrieve the pledges. And his buddy, his good old buddy, the Adullamite, couldn't find her. She's gone. This is no harlot. She just did a one-time dalliance. And you also realize that she had to have known that she was able to get pregnant at that time. And verse 22, the Adullamite returned to Judah and said, I can't find her. And the men of the place said, there's no harlot here. In other words, this was all a shock. Who are you talking about? Well, you know that Judah trusted his friend Hira the Adullamite to keep this matter secret. They were clearly close friends. Like, okay, keep your mouth shut and your head down. Everything will be fine. Nobody will ever find out, right? Well, after all, this was the same guy that arranged Judah's first marriage. And so, but in the heat of the moment, when Judah was bargaining with Tamar, he made a decision that would come back to haunt him with the three forms of personal identification. Now, he couldn't very well go personally back to whoever he thought the roadside harlot was to get it back, because that itself would be revealing and condemning. And so, and it was also custom, if we read in Deuteronomy 24, starting in verse 10, if you give a pledge, you know, a piece of collateral, you're not supposed to go into the house to collect it. Deuteronomy 24, 10 through 13. Don't go into the house to fetch his pledge. Let them have to bring it to you. Well, as it happened in Genesis 20, 38, verse 24, Tamar became pregnant and was discovered. And so in Genesis 38, verse 24, and it came to pass about 3 months afterwards, it was told to Judah, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, and behold, she's with child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burnt. In other words, you're not going to have that kind of behavior among the children of Israel. Now, I read a number of commentaries that the death penalty by burning was only done to a daughter of a priest, whereas the death penalty by stoning was the standard method used by everyone else. So in Leviticus 21, verse 9, we read, the daughter of any priest, if she profane herself by playing the whore, she profanes her father, she shall be burnt with fire. So in short, Judah set himself up and Tamar to a higher standard, a standard reserved for priests, by declaring that Tamar, being pregnant out of wedlock, must be burned rather than stoned. Now, if we take a look at the Bible commentary by Schultz, burning harlots was practiced by the Hittites and Philistines of that region. So it's possible that Tamar's father was a priest of another religion. And that happened, if we read back in the story of Samson. In the story of Samson, we read a case in Judges 15 and verse 6 about how the Philistines came up and burnt a woman with fire from a similar accusation. But the commentary by Schultz goes on to point out that the levirate obligations of a father-in-law in marrying a widowed daughter-in-law was allowed among the Hittites, but not among the Israelites. You see, Tamar wasn't subject to punishment under local law for deceiving Judah into becoming pregnant. Well, regardless of how the death penalty was supposed to be carried out, the judgment conflicted with a principle that a pregnant woman couldn't be put to death because that would kill an innocent life. We read in Genesis 20, 38, verse 25 and 26, that this principle of Judah then declaring her to be burned was a conflict. So Judah was really between a rock and a hard place. Things weren't working out too well for him because of the sin of Judah. So he was openly shamed and embarrassed by the revelation. He had condemned Tamar to a horrible death to be burned. He openly confessed that by comparison with Judah, Tamar acted more honorably than Judah. And as the facts became known, Tamar had the legal right to bear Judah's heir, and it was Judah who acted dishonorably. And Judah noted he was under greater condemnation than Tamar. Not only was it widely and publicly exposed that Judah had bargained to consort with the presumed harlot. With three pieces of ID, you can't say, well, he didn't bargain. Of course he did. And there was a child forthcoming to remind Judah and everyone else of this indiscretion for the rest of his life. But you'll notice, if we look at Leviticus 20, verse 12, Judah didn't marry Tamar. He did take responsibility for her care and the care of her children. Judah was forbidden from marrying his daughter-in-law by Hebrew law under Leviticus 20, verse 12. And so then we step into Genesis 38, verse 27, to really make things interesting. Tamar had twin sons. Now, and you're going, huh, what? Well, if you stop and you think about it, even probable that Tamar was over the age of 35 when she conceived the twins at the time. Now, she had married two successive husbands, and they had died, and she waited 10 to maybe 15 years or more for the third son to grow up. Statistically, the likelihood of twins is three times greater for a mother who's age 35 or more. And so if you look at the age difference and the number of waiting, it's not unexpected. Now, the normal statistic is 1 in 89 births for twins, but it triples for women who were over 35. It triples again if the maternal grandmother had twins, and it triples again if the next great-grandmother had twins. I have a set of twins, and all of those things were true. I told my dad, well, there's 14 sets of twins on mother's side, and he sat down and he said, well, let's see, let's go in five generations. He says, let's go back, and he says, well, there's 25 sets of twins on your side. So it's a wonder that all of your children were twins, because the mother was over 35. So, but anyway, if you take a look, what happens next is in Genesis 38, verse 28. It came to pass, she, meaning Tamar, travailed in birth. One put out his hand. Well, that must be the firstborn. So what did the midwife do? Tied a ribbon or scarlet thread on it, saying, well, this one's the firstborn. And then it came out to pass, that hand came back, and the brother came out first, and she goes, how did this happen? You know, this is a midwife, you know, is really, really befuddled here. Well, now, which one do you call the firstborn? We got a challenge here. And when I read about that unusual circumstance, I couldn't figure it out at first either. And I had to read and look and understand the inheritance laws, because there was confusion during the birthing process of which of the twin sons was firstborn. Each of them had somewhat tenuous claim to the title of being firstborn. But one thing we can say is true. Judah's third son had been replaced by both babies, because each one of those had been born, each of them replacing Ur and Onan, Judah's older son. So there it happened. The third son, Shelah, was slipped back into third place behind his two younger brothers. Now, if Judah had kept his word, honored the Levirate marriage law, Judah's third son would have taken Tamar as a wife, and Tamar had borne a son to Shelah, then that would have been accounted for inheritance purposes. But the third son didn't marry Tamar, and the rest, as they say, is history. So an apparent attempt to gain the entire Judah's and Jacob's estate for himself, then still holding on to hope, when Shelah did have a son, he named his firstborn Ur. In other words, hoping maybe that will stimulate a possibility of inheritance, but that didn't happen. In fact, the naming children after their uncles is a common practice. It's been going on for thousands of years. I was often puzzled by in the neighborhood where I grew up, German immigrant farmers, and I remember there was a custom of uncles and nephews being named after their uncles. And I remember there was two Ed Ottos, Ed the older and Ed the younger, nephew or uncle and nephew. There were two Henry Ottos, young Henry and old Henry. And so it went through the neighborhood. As a kid, you're going, huh, what? What? Until you realize this was a pattern. Now, incidentally, the sons of Shelah had to have been born in Egypt. after the children of Israel, of Jacob, had relocated there during the seven-year famine. And we know this because the entire listing of Jacob and all of his offspring were counted out and named, but Shelah's sons were not named as traveling to Egypt. So we know they were born later. And we read that in Genesis 46, and it goes down the line and reads out all of those. And if we read between the lines, we discover that if Tamar was yet alive, we're left to presume that she also went to Egypt with Judah and Judah's household, although her twin sons had their own babies by that time, so she would have been grandmother by the time if she went to Egypt. And we read that about that in Numbers 26, verses 19 through 22. Well, all of this is an interesting story. We can all wash our hands and shake them dry and hope everything will be fine, right? But what's the message here? Why is this included in the Bible? This inset chapter between chapter 37 and 39, you have this unseemly chapter 38. I mean, what are we supposed to take from it? Well, first of all, if we go to John 6:44, we read that, you know, God the Father called and chose us. It was Judah that was the father who arranged marriages for his sons. He initially chose Tamar to be the mother of his descendants. Judah reinforced the choice when he instructed Tamar to marry a second son and later contracted for Tamar to marry the third son. She was chosen to be the mother of Judah's heir. She was chosen by inclusion to be a member of the tribe of Israel. And so, similarly, God the Father has chosen us who follow him to be in his kingdom. No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up on the last day, the potential for resurrection. In Acts 2, verse 39, for the promise, we're talking about the Abrahamic promise, for the promise is to you and your children and to all that are far off, even as many as the Lord our God shall call. See, our calling comes from God. We've chosen to become the members of the spiritual tribe of Israel. Now, the Apostle Paul, in writing to the Galatians, refers to converted people as being part of the Israel of God. Now, Judah was the heir of Jacob, also named Israel. And it didn't matter the heirs the children of Israel, it didn't matter about their biological ancestry. In Galatians 6, in verse 15, in Galatians 6, verse 15, we read, for in Christ Jesus neither circumcision avails anything nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. Verse 16, as many as walk according to this rule, meaning the law of God, peace be on them and mercy and upon the Israel of God. But unlike Judah, God keeps his word. In Psalm 119, verse 160, your word is true. Psalm 119, 160, your word is true from the beginning, and every one of the righteous judgments endures forever. So God's going to keep his word. Then we are told in Job 27, verse 6, that we're to hold fast to our calling. You see, Tamar hung on to her calling, however it was imperfect, however impatient, but she held fast to that calling. In Job 27, verse 6, my righteousness I hold fast, I will not let it go, my heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. In Hebrews 10, in verse 23, repeats this. Hebrews 10, 23, let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And in 2 Peter 1:10, wherefore, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure, for if you do these things, you shall never fail. So Tamar kept a firm grip on her right to be the mother of the heirs of Judah. Next point that we should recall is that we will be part of an arranged marriage. Judah selected and arranged for Tamar to be the bride of his sons. And this is a physical prototype of God's arrangement for us. And we read this when Jesus himself gave the example in Matthew 22, verse 2. In Matthew 22, verse 2, we read, "The kingdom of heaven is like to a certain king which made a marriage for his son." Jesus used this example of saying joining the family of God and is like a marriage for his son, of course, being Jesus Christ and God the Father. And then we read the parable of the 10 bridesmaids in Matthew 25, verse 1. Again, it's an analogy of entering the kingdom of God, for being a bridesmaid to enter through the marriage with the son. In Revelation 19, verse 7, really wraps it up tight. In Revelation 19, verse 7, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife makes herself ready. And he said to me, write, blessed are they which are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true sayings of God." So the resurrection, potential for resurrection, is likened to a marriage that to join the kingdom of God. So in this sense, we are part of an arranged marriage, as Judah arranged marriages for his sons. We also learn from this story about Tamar that God emphasizes the importance of the firstborn and his inheritance. The emphasis of the firstborn is really a physical prototype, a forerunner of what's going to happen spiritually, that Jesus Christ was going to be the firstborn of many brethren. We read in Exodus 34, verse 39, we are told that whoever opens the matrix is mine, meaning God's, and the first among the cattle, whether it's ox or sheep. In other words, there was an honoring of the firstborn. Jesus Christ would, of course, the firstborn in his immediate human family, as we read the story about his mother Mary. But most importantly, Jesus Christ was the firstborn person from the dead, the firstborn into a new resurrection, so he becomes the hope and destiny of mankind. In Colossians 1, verse 18, in Colossians 1, 18, Paul is writing about Jesus when he said, he's the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, and in all things that he might have preeminence. Well, we're here today as part of the church of the firstborn. In Hebrews 12, verse 23, to the general assembly and the church of the firstborn, who are written in heaven, to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. You see, we're part of the first, if we're part of the first resurrection, we are what the writer of the book of Hebrews calls the better resurrection. In Hebrews 11, 35, we read that women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. So we know there's more than one. And the better one, of course, is honored as the firstborn. What the writer is referring to is spelled out in 1 Thessalonians 4, 16. It's about the resurrection of the saints upon the return of Christ at the onset of the millennial kingdom of God at the end of this age. To the Apostle Paul in Colossians 1, 15, then wrote about in the congregation to Colossus, about Christ being the firstborn from the dead and the firstborn of the spiritual resurrection. In Colossians 1, verse 15, he called him the firstborn of every creature, of all creation, indeed. And then we read down to verse 18. He's the head of the body, the church, who's the beginning, the firstborn of the dead, that in all things he might have preeminence. God places a value on our calling and our determination, meaning our choice to make that calling sure, and on the understanding that we're part of an arranged marriage with Jesus Christ, and we will be then among the firstborn of the family of God. The story of Tamar prepares us to understand two chapters in the New Testament in particular speak to our understanding of salvation. I would encourage you to read the chapters Ephesians 1, it's 23 verses, the whole chapter. Ephesians 1 and Hebrews 1, verses 1 through 13, it's the whole chapter. And having gone through this understanding about inheritance and the story of Tamar. Let's read both of those chapters with what we've learned. So how do we summarize the lessons from the life of Tamar? God is the author of our calling who draws us. We must hold, second, we must hold fast to our calling. Third, we will be part of an arranged marriage. And fourth, God emphasizes the importance of the firstborn and his inheritance. We all have hope to become the heirs of Christ, to be counted as firstborn with Jesus Christ, and to inherit eternal life then in the kingdom of God.